בשם השם נעשה ונצליח. Okay. So this is a talk that was given in March 2017 for Rabbeim and educators about compulsive behavior in the area of Kedusha. It was given to Rabbeim. We had a nice turnout. There was a problem with the recording, so we're re-recording it right now for everyone's benefit. In April 2017, not much has changed. And let's begin. Okay, so this talk accompanied a slideshow. So if you want me to email that slideshow to you, please send me an email. avitenenbaum9@gmail.com. Okay, avitenenbaum9@gmail.com. That's my email. And we're going to be going over the slideshow as if you're looking at it, but I think you'll be able to understand it for the most part without looking at it as well. Okay, so the beautiful event was sponsored by Shlavim. Shlavim is a very important organization if you are a Rebbe or educator or a Bacher. Okay, Shlavim is a referral agency, a nonprofit organization. They do not receive any fee for their services. Basically, if there's a Bacher in Eretz Yisrael that has some sort of a problem, maybe he doesn't even know what to call the problem, he doesn't know who to turn to for the problem, Shlavim is the place to go. You call their number. They make an appointment with the Bacher, they interview them, they try to understand what's going on, and they set them up with the proper help that Bacher needs. Shlavim has helped many, many people in Eretz Yisrael since they've started. It's great to know how to get in touch with them. Their number is 02-374-0278. They have an American number, 248-509-8131. They have a website, www.shlavim.org, which is spelled shlavim.org. They also have an email, contact@shlavim.org. Okay. So my name is Avi Tenenbaum. I studied the subject of compulsive sexual behavior for about 5 or 6 years in depth. I've read hundreds of studies on the topic. I've spoken to other professionals. I have a lot of experience in this area, particularly the fact that it came from the Olam HaYeshiva and the fact that it's a pretty popular issue in the yeshiva world. And that doesn't mean to say that it's more of a problem there than in other places, but it certainly exists. And I mean, Ma'asim B'chol Yom, I meet with Bacharim all the time. And we're going to be giving this to Rabbeim from that perspective of meeting these Bacharim, being in yeshiva myself, and remembering some Bacharim that had these issues. And the goals for today, if you have the slideshow, we're going to start on slideshow number 3. The goals today are to help Rabbeim, Avreichim, whoever's listening to this, maybe it's even Bacharim themselves, to be able to differentiate between a more serious type of problem in this area from a less serious problem. And obviously, accordingly, what type of help does the person need? Does the person need to learn more Mussar? Does the person need a rehab program? Does the person need to see a therapist? Does he need the 12 steps? Does he need to have a talk with the mashkiach? Does he need to go get a job? Does he need to get married? Those are all great questions. So we're going to try to, hopefully by the end of today, have a bit of a better understanding of what's a more serious problem, what's a less serious problem. We're going to try to identify a great variety of behaviors in which this problem can appear. Because this problem, compulsive sexual behavior, actually does take place in many forms. It takes place with people. It takes place on the internet. It takes place in many, many different ways, and later on we'll touch on that. We're going to try to understand as well later on, what does treatment look like? What does it involve? Does it involve bloodletting? Does it involve going into a cave for 100 days and fasting? Does it involve lots of money? What does it involve? It's a very important question. If I'm sending a Bacher to treatment, I want to know, what does it involve? If the Bacher himself is going for treatment, what does it take to get help for addiction? What does it involve? Finally, hopefully we're going to get time to say what resources are available for Talmidim with this problem. But even if we don't talk about that at all, you can call Shlavim, like we said before, and they will certainly know. They'll set up the Bacher with who he hopefully will be able to be receiving help from, and he'll be matzliach, he'll get better. Okay. Before I forget, you can look at my website, www.jnars.org. On my website, I have a button called Recovery Resources, and there's all sorts of resources there for people that are not professionals. They want to understand more about addiction itself. They want to understand what resources exist in the world or in the Jewish world. I have a whole list there of all sorts of links. Hopefully that could also be helpful to somebody. Okay, so let's begin the actual presentation. Let's run through this. So we're on slide number 4. Okay, so the Torah tells us that Yisroel had 7 names. We have Reuel, Yeser, Yisroi, Choyvev, Chever, Keni, and Putil. Right? So this is not 7 different people. This is one person, Yisroel, with 7 different names. Obviously, each name, there's a reason why he has 7 names. It's because each name is highlighting a different characteristic about the same person. The reason why we talk about Yisroel is because if you look on slide 5 in the presentation, as I studied this subject, I found 11 different names in the professional literature for the same problem. The reason why that's important to know is because that makes this issue very confusing to talk about when you're talking with other professionals or when you're talking with other rabbeim that spoke to other professionals. There's so many different names flying around for the same issue. Each name implies perhaps a different derech, a different method in how to treat the issue. And let's just run through the names right now. Okay, so number 1, sexual addiction, which implies it's an addiction. Number 2, sexual impulsivity. It implies that this person is impulsive. Perhaps he has an impulsive impulse control disorder. Okay, number 3, compulsive sexual behavior. Or 4, impulsive compulsive sexual behavior. Or 5, obsessive compulsive sexual spectrum disorder. All these fancy mumbo-jumbo names are saying that the person has an OCD sort of problem, which is characterized as an anxiety disorder. 6, this person has hypersexuality. Okay, maybe that implies he has too much libido. I don't know what it implies. 7, he has problematic hypersexuality. 8, he's dysregulated sexuality. 9, sexual behavior that is out of control, which is a name which is not even saying what the type of problem is. It's just telling you it's sexual behavior that's out of control. 10, sexual disorder not otherwise specified. In other words, we don't want to give this a name. We're just going to call it not otherwise specified. It's unknown. 11, this is a really fancy name for you out there that are professionals. This name comes from the ICD-10 from the World Health Organization. Psoriasis and nymphomania. Okay, so we got through the different names of the B'nai Haman over here. Not in one breath. We'll try that next time. But the point is that it has many different names. There's a huge debate about how to characterize this problem, as we'll see in slide number 6. Okay, so slide number 6, we have 3 main debates surrounding this issue. Debate number 1, this issue, is it a primary issue? Is it a primary disorder? In other words, is it a problem in its own right? And it belongs in its own category, it has its own name, and perhaps it has its own method of treatment? Or maybe it's a symptom of something else. Maybe it's a symptom of depression. Maybe it's a symptom of trauma. Maybe it's a symptom of anxiety. In other words, it's not a problem in its own right. It's just a symptom that something else is going on, which implies that if you treat the something else, this will disappear. If you treat the anxiety, this sexual stuff will disappear. Okay, that is a debate in its own right. And in that debate, there's even a third party, which is the most extreme. They say that it's a subclinical problem. In other words, it's not even worth calling a problem. And the whole problem is just because you call it a problem. You make people all nervous about this. Stop calling it a problem. Normalize it for everybody. Tell them that everybody does these things. And don't even waste your time talking about it. That itself gives it attention, negative attention, and makes it a problem. Okay, so that's debate number 1. Is it its own problem? Is it a symptom of something else? Or maybe it's not even a problem and you shouldn't call it a problem. Debate number 2. Let's say that it is a problem in its own right. But what type of problem is it? Is it a type of OCD issue? Is it a trauma issue? Is it an addiction issue? What is it? Debate number 3 says, depending on how you told me debate number 2's answer, in other words, let's say you call it an addiction, for example, and you tell me that not only do drugs and alcohol be considered addiction, right? Things which go in your guf, right? Drugs and alcohol. But you even are telling me now, a chiddush, you're telling me that even sexual behavior is an addiction, or gambling, which is a behavior also, right? So if you're going to tell me that a behavior is an addiction, so where do you draw the line? What's considered an addiction and what's not? And that's important to know, because if there's a specific method of treating addiction, I need to know what fits into that category. Drugs and alcohol have a certain method. You're telling me that sexual behavior also fits into that category, so we should use that method. So let's say, for example, now you have a bachur or a seminary girl that does self-harm. Okay, it's not uncommon. Let's say you have a girl, she's slitting her wrists. This is a way maybe to get attention. Maybe it's a way to relieve anxiety. There are all sorts of reasons why a person might be doing this. But let's say you have a student that they're cutting their wrists. Okay, and they get some benefit from this. Is that also an addiction? Does the method of addiction work for that person too? Okay, so that's debate number three. How do you define addiction? Depending on how you define it, how far do you take it, and where do you draw the line? Okay, so basically, just keep in mind, it's a pretty complicated subject in the professional world, and that doesn't make it any easier for our bachurim. It just makes it much harder, because depending on which professional you send them to, depending on what you read on the internet, depending on which professional diagnostic manual you read, that is what you're going to understand the bachur needs. So it's a pretty serious problem. There are problems that are much more clear-cut, like depression or anxiety. But anyhow, hopefully we're going to try to step in and fill in the gap a little bit. Okay, so moving on to slide number 7. So let's talk here about some things which point us in the direction of a more serious issue. Okay, none of these things by themselves are going to make it that a person has an addiction, but they're all clues. They're all signs. They're all, you know, if I hear that a person has these things, I suspect that there might be a more serious issue at hand. Okay, so let's talk about that. So on slide number 7, we have two characteristics or features that if the person we're talking about, the bachur, the avrich, has these two things, we start to say maybe he has a more serious issue at hand. So A, the first one, A, is loss of control. Okay, the person has a loss of control. In other words, there are many ways to define loss of control. So let's say some ways to define that. Let's say that this person, he has a Yetzer Hara. He looked at pornography for the sake of example. He looked at it for 1 minute. And the next day, he looks at it for 2 minutes. And the next day, 3 minutes. And before you know it, 10 minutes and 20 minutes and half an hour and 2 hours and 3 hours. And it gets more and more. And he really only intended to look for 1 minute. Every time, he just meant to look one time for 1 minute. And before you know it, he's looking for longer and longer periods of time than he intended. Okay, so the point is not that it got longer and longer and longer, but the point is he really meant every one of those 20 times to look for 1 minute. And he ends up looking for longer than 1 minute 20 times. So that is some sort of a sign that this person has a loss of control, right? A different way to show loss of control is that the person is looking in greater quantity. So in the case that we gave, he's also looking in greater quantity. He's not just looking once a day and that's it, right? He's looking once a day for 1 minute, and it ends up being for 10 minutes. It ends up being for 20 minutes. It ends up being for half an hour. The same thing would be true if the person only looks for 1 minute. But he says, I want to look at pornography for just 1 minute once a day. And he ends up looking for 1 minute 17 times a day or 3 times a day. Again, that's more than he intended. And that is a sign of loss of control. So the point is, he planned plan A, and before you know it, he ends up doing plan B. Okay, so he pulls the rug under his own feet, and he's doing something different than he intended. That's a loss of control. That's a possible sign of a loss of control. Okay, another way that you have loss of control is that, let's say the person only wanted to look at less intense, inappropriate images. Let's take pornography as an example. We'll see later on that pornography is just one of many, many, many ways that we could be discussing this problem. So don't think pornography is the issue. There are many ways that this problem can show up. But anyhow, let's just take that for example. Let's say he says he's just going to look at the, you know, clothing websites, and he's going to look at ladies, you know, putting on different dresses and looking nice. And he doesn't intend to look at anything more intense than that. And yet, when it comes to Zman Emet, when it comes to what's actually happening, he finds himself quickly, or maybe gradually, moving on to much more intense things, much more graphic things, okay, without getting into details. We're going to try to keep Kovod Rosh and Tznius as much as possible, by the way, in the presentation. When we feel we have to be more explicit, we're going to do that, in line with the Gemara in Pesachim, at the beginning of the Gemara there. But anyhow, the idea is he meant to look at something less intense. Before you know it, he's looking at something more intense. And that itself is a type of loss of control, because he planned A and he did B. Okay? Another way loss of control is efforts to cut down the behavior which he's trying to stop. Okay? If he makes several efforts to cut down this behavior or to stop the behavior and he is unsuccessful, that would also point in the direction that this person has a loss of control. Okay, we're going to give examples in the next slide, I think, of what that might mean. But just for one simple example, let's say a person takes a shvua, Hashem, I swear I will never look at pornography again. And guess what he does the next day? He looks at pornography. Okay, so he does this one time, maybe he does it two times, three times. So he made an effort to cut down, but it was not successful. Okay, usually, when you're talking about a person with a more serious issue, he's made many efforts to cut down in many different ways. And you end up making a list and you see that this guy's done 10 different things to try to cut down, and it's never helped. Okay, you put that all together, and that points you in the direction that this person has a loss of control over the behavior that we're talking about. So all that, everything about loss of control is just one part of the picture. Loss of control. The other important characteristic, which is going to point us in the direction of a more serious issue, is continuation despite adverse consequences. Okay? Basically, in English, the person has consequences. The person suffers some sort of punishment, some sort of problem as a result of the behavior that he's doing, and he knows that it's a problem. He knows he's going to lose out, or he lost out in the past, and he does it anyways. Okay, so let's give some examples. Let's say a person ends up looking at pornography so much that he doesn't spend time anymore with any of his friends. He doesn't go out to meals anymore. He's just all by himself, and he feels much isolation. He feels all by himself, and this is painful for him, and yet he continues anyways. So there's a social consequence. Okay, or let's say there is a psychological consequence. Let's say the bachur is looking at this stuff or doing this stuff, and he feels so terrible about it. He feels broken. He has a broken heart. He can't function 2 days after each time that he does these things, but yet he continues anyways, despite the fact that it's so painful and it's so problematic, he does it anyways. Okay, let's give a different example. Let's say the bachur is looking at pornography all night, and he never gets any sleep. And by not getting sleep, he gets sick. He gets sick all the time because he's not getting enough sleep. That's a type of consequence. Or let's say he's a truck driver or a cab driver, or he is a painter, and now his job is very hazardous because as it is, it's a bit dangerous to drive, and as it is, it's a bit dangerous to stand on a ladder and paint houses, and now he's doing it when he's exhausted. Okay? Whatever it is, there's some sort of a consequence. He's suffering as a result of this, and yet he does it anyways. It's important to mention when we talk about consequences in Bachrim, you have to keep in mind that Bachrim, or any single person for that matter, in the Western world, they don't necessarily always have so many consequences to lose. So you have to keep an eye out when you talk about single people, what consequences they are facing, because it's not the same as, I'm going to give an example. Let's say you have a married person who he's married, so he could lose his marriage. He has kids, he can lose custody of his kids. He has a job, he can lose his job, okay? When you have a bachur that he doesn't have to cook, he doesn't have to make any money, no matter what happens, food will be there for him. Maybe he's in a very, very large yeshiva where they don't even notice if he comes and goes, okay? No one's going to notice if he misses a few days or a few hours, or if he comes late every day, no one's going to reprimand him for this. No one's going to tell him, if you miss one more time, you're out of the yeshiva. So the consequences for a bachur sometimes are a little bit hard to discern or pick up. Okay, but of course it does happen. There are other types of consequences, like we said. The consequence that the guy is sleeping all morning and missing yeshiva, and he's suffering from that physically, or maybe he's depressed that he can't learn anymore because he's always busy sleeping because he's busy looking at pornography, or maybe he's walking around feeling depressed with a broken heart, or maybe maybe he does his addiction in front of other people because, you know, he goes onto the yeshiva computers in the computer room, and there's a risk that people will notice. And let's say somebody noticed already, and he suspects that people think he's looking at pornography, and it's very embarrassing. And yet, out of desperation, he does it anyways. Okay? So there's all sorts of ways that you can be talking about consequences with a bachur. We're going to talk about in a second on slide number 8 some more examples. Okay? Let's say that the bachur was warned by the yeshiva. Listen, bachur, if you miss Seder one more time, you're out of the dorm. That's it. Okay? If he is playing around at night and exhausted and he stands to miss chakras again and he's playing with fire, that's a type of consequence. Okay? Let's talk about examples of efforts to cut down. Okay? Because we spoke about also, if a person tries many different ways to cut down and he's not successful, this is a sign of a loss of control. Okay, so if you go on websites like guardyoureyes.com, which is a great website, we'll get to it later on in the presentation, hopefully, you'll see people making lists of 20 or 30 things that they did over their period of acting out to try to stop the behavior. And of course, none of them ever worked, or they worked very little, and then it stopped working. I don't remember about Pat 20 or 30 ways, but I'll tell you a few ways that my bachram that I meet, you know, these are common things that the guys that I meet, they tell me. Okay, so one way is they put their tefillin under their pillow, and yet they find themselves out, for example, acting out in their bed, rubbing themselves against the bed, being Moitzi Zeron Lavatala in the bed. They can't stop doing that, despite the fact that they've put their tefillin under their pillow or next to their head as some way of trying to have Yiras Shamayim, as a way of trying to stop. Okay, similarly but different, they put a Mesilas Yesharim in their bed, they put a Reishis Chachma in their bed, whatever it is. Okay, here's a third way which is quite popular. A bachur makes a shavua or a neder that he will never do this thing again. And of course he does it again. Another way is he says that if he acts out again, he's going to give $100 to tzedakah, which is very significant, by the way, for some bachurim because they don't have money. Or they have money, but their mothers are going to ask, why do you keep taking so much money out of the bank? Okay? So he says, each time I act out, I promise I will give $100 to tzedakah. And guess what happens? It doesn't stop. He keeps on acting out, and he keeps on giving this $100, and it just doesn't help him to slow down. Okay? Another way is, this is more extreme, bachurim that fast, or they punish themselves in different ways by acting out. Okay, so for example, I had a bachur that he said, each time he acts out, he's going to go to the spring behind Kever Shmuel HaNavi, which is here in Ramot. I could actually see it from my window here. So there's a little spring behind Kever Shmuel HaNavi, and it's freezing, freezing cold in the winter, as you can imagine. And this guy said, anytime he acts out, he's going to take a cab to Kever Shmuel HaNavi, take off all his clothing, and dip in the freezing cold spring there in the middle of the open behind Kever Shmuel HaNavi. And of course, the guy did this 20, 30, 40 times, but he continued to act out. It didn't help him to stop. Okay, some people write a contract with Hashem. Hashem, I love you. I'm your servant. I promise I'll never do this again. And of course, after they sign this official document, they go and do it again. It's very special, by the way, and I'm not being mezalzel in any of the efforts that these people make. And ani ma'amin be'amun ha'shleima, the schar that they get, ani ma'amin the nachas ruach that Hashem gets for anything that they do to try to stop. But the point is that clinically, these things are showing you a loss of control because they go out of their way to do a special technique to help them stop, which they assess would be helpful, and it doesn't help. They continue anyways. Okay, sometimes you have people that they cry and beg Hashem to help them stop. They go to different tzaddikim. You know, it's on Yom Kippur, they cry and they're so serious. They are so sincere. And the next day they act out. Maybe they add extra learning to their schedule until they're so busy that they're always in the Beis Medrash and they never have time to act out, because acting out takes some time, of course. Kol Shekein, if a person is acting out with other people, they have to go find those people and find a place to act out. If it's pornography, it takes time, usually, not always. It doesn't take time if it's in his phone and it's under his covers, but it takes some time, obviously, in looking at the stuff itself. But before you know it, the guy does this anyways. Even though he's keeping himself so, so busy, he's still acting out. V'chein hala, okay? V'chadoyme. You can imagine more and more examples. Okay, so we move down to slide number 9. So on slide number 9, we're saying a following point, which is very important to keep in mind. Although something can be an avera, or it could be forbidden, or it could be foolish, or it could be immoral, it could be unacceptable, but that doesn't mean that it points in the area of an addiction. An addiction is a chronic brain disorder which is featured mainly by a loss of control and continuation despite severe consequences. Okay, so the fact that a person is looking at pornography, that doesn't itself mean that this person has an addiction. You know, there's a lot of people that look at pornography. Maybe this guy doesn't have Yiras Shamayim. He doesn't care. He doesn't care that it's immoral. Or maybe he doesn't care to do Esh Hazish. He could care less. The Gemara says that a Baal Gaiva is going to be Nechshol on Esh Hazish. This guy's a Baal Gaiva. He doesn't care. That doesn't make it a clinical problem. That doesn't make it an addiction problem. That doesn't mean he has to go to therapy. He definitely needs help. Perhaps he needs help. He needs to learn more. He needs Musar. He needs a lot of things. But when we're talking in this presentation, we're talking about a clinical issue. Okay? So again, the fact that a person sees a culturally unacceptable behavior in the yeshiva world, or something which is usher according to the Torah, or the fact that he does something many times, but without a loss of control, that doesn't make it an addiction. The fact that a client feels guilty also doesn't necessarily make something an addiction. Okay? A person can feel guilty because they have Yiras Shamayim and they feel bad about what they did. But that doesn't make it an addiction. I think that's a very special thing, that a person feels guilty that he acted out. He went against his own religion. He learned about this. He learned about how it's an avera. He feels bad about it. I think we call that charata. That's a very nice thing. It's great. But it doesn't make it an addiction. Okay, so it's important to keep that in mind. We also said that if somebody, let's say, is moitzi zarah lavatala 5 or 6 times a day, that doesn't necessarily make something an addiction. Again, you have to remember who we're talking about. So if you're a campus rabbi, and you're on a college campus with some college kid who acts out 5-6 times a day, and you find out about that somehow, that could be what college guys do. That could be the culture in that place. Of course, it's a Torah issue, but that doesn't necessarily make it a clinical issue. Okay, so again, the two main things you want to look for when you're talking about a clinical issue is a loss of control and continuation of the behavior despite severe consequences. Okay, so we've moved on to slide number 10. Once you've established also that there's a loss of control, and also that this guy is continuing despite consequences, so then there's a few more things that will fill in the picture here. One is that this person is giving up different social or occupational or recreational activities as a result of engaging in this behavior. In other words, let's say this guy has a Bekiah Seder at night, and he really enjoys learning Bekiahs. This guy comes from Neri Yisrael, you know, one of these yeshivas where they pound Bekiahs, and they finish Masechta after Masechta, and this guy had a Seder to do that at night. And now he's giving this up because he's busy spending his time acting out. So he's giving up something which is recreational, or something which he enjoys, or something that's important to him. So that, again, is coming after loss of control, after continuation, despite consequences. This piece is coming to kind of fill in the picture a little bit more. Perhaps this guy has different responsibilities that people rely on him for at work, or in yeshiva, or at home. Maybe it's a husband that's supposed to be doing certain things at home, or of course he's at work and he has certain jobs that he has to take care of, and the business is relying on him to get those things done at a certain time, and he's not doing them. Okay, so he's falling behind in work, he's falling behind in his learning. Okay, let's say he's supposed to give supper to the kids, and the kids every day are complaining that for half an hour after they come home from school, they're hungry and Tati isn't giving them food. You know, he's in his room, we don't know what he's doing, so you and I know what he's doing. So he's failing to engage in a certain role that he has, and that is coming to fill in the picture. Okay, another thing that comes to fill in the picture is that a great deal of time is spent in the behavior that he's doing, or a great time on the clock is spent to recover from its effects. Okay, this is very common with the people I meet. Let's say a bachur tells you, Rebbe, after I act out, I feel so bad about myself. I can't function for 2 days. I feel dizzy. I don't know what's going on. I feel completely disconnected from my surroundings. And that goes for 2 days. So that's an example of a great deal of time spent to recover from the effects of the behavior. Okay, that's an example again, which is coming to fill in the picture. Another thing to fill in the picture is that a person has strong urges or very strong desires to engage in the behavior. Now, when I talk about an urge, I'm not talking about a Yetzer Hara. Everybody has a Yetzer Hara, unless you kill the Yetzer Hara, like David HaMelech and Samichi Deskuga, Libi Chal Bekirbi. So unless you've killed the Yetzer Hara, you have one, and if you have one, it's great. Look in the Tanya, look in the Svar Makdoshim, they talk about the importance of having Yetzer Hara, right? Chazal say, B'shnei Yitzrecha, right? You're supposed to serve Hashem with the Yetzer Hara. So it's great to have one. So we're not talking about that, but when we talk about a craving or an urge, we're talking about a really powerful, almost overwhelming physiological urge. Okay, this happens a lot with people that I meet. They're literally walking down the street, and either they see something which brings on the urge, sometimes they don't even see anything, it's just a body thing, it just comes. And before you know it, they're feeling these painful urges. And I use the word painful because they're very uncomfortable. And they're so uncomfortable to the point where a person needs to relieve himself from this uncomfortable feeling. And of course, you can imagine the bachur will relieve this feeling by acting out. That is a very quick and easy way to relieve the feeling. Okay, so we're talking about just things that come to fill in the picture of things which point towards a more serious clinical issue. The person in question has very strong cravings, more than regular, to engage in the behavior. Okay, it's almost like a craziness sometimes. People describe it in a lot of different ways. People in the 12-step groups call it insanity. Literally, the person feels like they've just, all they can think about, they have complete domination in their mind about acting out, and they feel energy running through their body. That's a type of urge, so that's what we're talking about. Okay, another few things, tolerance. Tolerance is something which fills in the picture, and it's very important to understand what it is. Tolerance means the need to engage in the behavior more often and in more intensity to achieve the desired effect. Okay, let's take the example of alcohol. Let's say that a person drinks alcohol. He's an alcoholic. And it used to be that if he just drank a beer, he got a buzz, and that buzz was exactly what he was trying to accomplish. And once he drinks that beer, he's done for a few hours until the buzz goes away. Okay, before you know it, a month later, his brain gets so used to this that it's not one beer, it's two. He needs two beers in order to accomplish the same effect that he's looking to accomplish. Okay, and before you know it, it becomes a pack of beer, it becomes a keg of beer, it becomes whiskey, whatever it becomes. The point is that the brain gets used to the behavior or the drug, and the brain basically says, I'm used to this now. So if you want to feel high, you're going to have to do it more than you were doing before. You're going to have to do it more intensely than you were doing before. This could be when we talk about pornography, just as an example. He used to look at soft type of pornography, but that doesn't do it for him anymore. Now he has to look at hard pornography. When we talk about acting out with other people, it used to be that acting out with girls did it for him. Now he has to act out with an Ashes Ish. Okay, sorry for the example, but these are just coming to try to explain how tolerance might work. Withdrawal is something else. It's also a famous characteristic of addiction. Withdrawal means that Basically, when because my brain and my body is used to this behavior or this drug, so now when I stop it and I don't have it in my system, I feel pain. My body changes. I get sick. Okay, I'm gonna read for you. It's a little bit tricky to explain this in short. So I'm gonna read to you the words on the slide on page 10 on the bottom. One way of explaining withdrawal is a characteristic biopsychological withdrawal syndrome of physiologically described changes and or psychologically described changes upon discontinuation of the behavior. Okay? There's a change in the way he feels, in his mood. He feels anxious. He feels sick now that he's not acting out. Okay, let's say it's Elul. Let's say it's Aseres Mei Tshuva. And he says, Hashem, I swear, these Aseres Mei Tshuva, I will not act out. I swear, I'm going to do this. And now his body was so used to having all these different hormones getting shot into his brain by looking at pornography. And now his brain is hungry for those hormones. Where's the dopamine? Where are all the different chemicals that are shot into the synapses in this guy's brain? He's not acting out right now. He's a tzaddik. He's doing tshuva. His body feels that change. And he gets sick. He feels uncomfortable. He feels pain. That happens either in his guf, it's biological, or it happens in his mind. Okay? He has problems with mood changes. He feels depressed. He feels anxious. And all this happens because he's not acting out and he's not doing the thing which his brain is used to having in order to function. Okay. Let's move on to slide number 11, and then we're going to take a break soon. Okay, so here's just a few last things to fill in the picture here. If a person has mental preoccupation with the behavior, okay, and I've met some people like this where they literally tell me, Avi, the only thing I can think about the entire day is acting out. I think about how I acted out last night. I think about when is the next opportunity I'm going to have to act out. I plan in my mind how I'm going to act out. Where am I going to get the money? Or where am I going to meet the girl? Or where am I going to get access to pornography? Or whatever the thing is that this guy's doing. And there's just complete domination and preoccupation in this person's mind. And I would say to the point where they literally arrange their life around the behavior. In other words, the goal, the thing that they want to do is act out. Everything is coming as a means to this end. Okay? People have this more or less, but it's basically mental preoccupation. Another common feature is that people engage in the behavior to relieve dysphoric moods. Okay? They feel not good. They feel sad, or they feel depressed. They feel scared. Maybe they feel anxious. They feel restless. So guess what they do? They act out to relieve those feelings. In other words, this is when a person basically takes sexual behavior and they turn it into a painkiller. Right? Just like when a person has a headache, you take aspirin and you don't feel the headache. This person feels depressed. He feels sad. Maybe he feels excluded. He feels rejected. He feels some emotion or he feels a physiological feeling in his body which is uncomfortable. Maybe he broke his leg and he feels pain in his leg. I don't know what he's feeling, but it's something that's not comfortable. And he uses sexual acting out as a way to cover up those feelings, as a way to relieve those feelings. He ends up learning to live all these feelings through acting out. I would even go so far as to say that once you take acting out away from him, he doesn't even know how to deal with all these feelings. And that's when you talk about therapy, that's one of the things that we actually help people do if a person needs therapy, is to figure out how could you feel anxious without acting out? And obviously, what's causing you anxiety? Because maybe we could even help with that as well. Okay, finally, a famous feature of gambling, which we're going to mention here as well, lying to conceal the extent of the behavior. That the person might be telling all sorts of lies to his wife, to his Rebbe, to his Chavrusa, to cover up what he's doing in order to get away with it. It's pretty sketchy that this guy keeps leaving the house at 2 in the morning and coming back at 4. And his wife keeps saying, Shimon, where did you go? And he makes up a different story each time. You know, and obviously he has to keep track of all the different stories. Sometimes he might be getting caught with that. It's a whole story in and of itself, the whole idea of lying. But lying is something which comes to fill in the picture. Of course, not everyone with these problems lies. It actually makes me very upset when people are not sensitive to people with these issues. They accuse all of them of being liars all the time. I don't think that's true, but it definitely can be part of the picture and filling in the picture, especially if the person has a loss of control, and especially if the person continues despite adverse consequences. Okay, let's take a little break. We're up to slide number 12. Before I forget, there were some things in the presentation when we gave it live, which I forgot to mention, and I wrote them down. I made some notes so that I can enter them into the slideshow later on. But for some reason, Siata Deshmaya, Shkachal Parates, I ended up not finding those notes, so I'm just going to try along the way to mention some of those points as I remember them. One of the points I wanted to make was, when we talk about a boy acting out, this whole topic is not limited to boys. Women and girls have these issues as well. The statistic goes that for every 4 men that engage in compulsive sexual behavior, there's 1 woman that does it. However, that doesn't mean that they do it less. It actually might mean that they just are so shamed about it because women are expected even more so to be in control of these things that even less women come and get help. So it's not necessarily that there are less women with this problem. It's just that we know about it even less than we know about men. Okay, let's take a break and we will come back.